seeds or something.
You know, see how it goes. If you don't like it, go back.
Can I switch your mic on, please?
Yeah. So in this minute, while we're just kind of getting cozy, I'm Jahanara, also Wendy Tremaine. I live in southern New Mexico, and this is my first event teaching for the Sufi Order, for the Unity Order. I came out of Salsabil, which is a 40-year salute class, a bunch of years back, maybe 2006. And I'm also a yogi, and today's subject is probably the nearest to a subject that I took on in a book that I wrote. It's the closest subject to my keynote, you could say, in my life. And maybe we can just take a moment, since we're small enough, to just go around and say who we are.
I'm Abdul Haq, that's the Sufi name, and Normund Akots is the regular one.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you in this area?
Yeah, I live in Portland.
Lucky so, you.
Yeah, it's nice.
My name is Lucas. That's my spiritual name. I'm from Eugene.
I'm Leslie, or Karima. I live here in Portland. I'm with the Rouhaniyat Order.
Inshallah.
My name is Shahana, and I come from Boston, and I have had the privilege of studying a little bit with you through Seven Pillars and various other opportunities to come in touch, so it's great to be a student.
I'm Tasneem, and I grew up here in Portland.
I sense that I have an abundance of resources for my need of a crash pad Monday night. We'll have to talk later about this.
Restaurants as well.
Oh gosh, I cannot wait.
I'm Joyce.
Hi.
Hi. I guess what we're saying where we're from. Seattle. Hi. I live in Seattle, born in Chicago, from another star system. Maybe. Maybe not.
So let's start with the invocation. Toward the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all of the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master. The spirit of guidance. I like to begin everything with breath, both personally and teaching. So let's start by anchoring ourselves into our breath, which really begins, of course, with our bodies, the vessel for breathing. So to make ourselves able to hold and move breath, let's begin with a tall seat. And a tall seat has a bottom that's heavy into the earth. And you might feel from that when you roll the shoulders back and lift the heart that the lift is a rebounding energy. It's a response to reaching downward with your seat. And we can broaden the collarbones to make this container for breath wider, bigger, and maybe even lean back a little. And then when the belly muscles engage, come forward slightly and find a spot that feels like the right amount of action. And we know we're a vessel for breathing when the belly is very soft and it can inflate like a balloon. The Sufis practice several aspects of breath, one being extending the breath far and away, so watching the breath unfurl and roll out into the life in front of us, and know that as it does, there's no boundary to the breath. The breath can effortlessly move through everything. On some level of magnification, everything is porous. And then that breath that goes out and experiences the world. If we push the last bits of the exhale out, become extra empty, pause there, then the inhale comes with some desire. We draw it back. And you may notice this naturally deepens the inhale, and likewise on the inside, we can pause at the top of the inhale. And that pause places us at the sort of edge of the opening to within, the edge of a very spacious interior from which the next breath comes. And beneath the breath, the current that provides the breath. Breathing like this, a few breaths, extending the exhale, pausing at the end to wait for the desire for the inhale. And then seeing the breath come within, meet us interiorly, every cell, every pore, bone, organ, teeth, nail, back of the eyes. Be reached. Extend the inhale and look for the turn back to the exhale. And today, since we're exploring Dunya and Jahan, two aspects of our being, a vertical aspect, our feet on the ground, but our head in the heavens, and a horizontal aspect, which is our life on the earth, which extends out from our heart. We'll bring the breath into this, drawing now the inhale up from our seat. You might see this seat like a pincushion pressed into the soft, moist soil, and further still, sending down a root. And then the inhale brings up energy from the earth, and maybe takes a moment to swirl the nav center behind the belly button, and then back down. Each breath, bringing it up, swirling, returning. Each breath ending with a pause at the end of the inhale, the apex of the exhale. And let the next breath bring up from the earth, pass through the nav, circle there, and into the heart in the left breast. And we might see this energy as effervescence, as illumination, but the result is a softening, an opening of the heart. So the inhale brings breath past the nafs, swirls further still into the heart, pause. The exhale washes back down from the heart to the belly button to the seat. And the next inhale, bring up from the earth, swirl around the nafs, bring the inhale further still to the heart. And across the chest to the right breast. And on the exhale, back down, right breast to left, to nafs, to seed. Everywhere it visits, it softens, brings effervescence. The next inhale climbs further still, nafs to heart, to right breast, to the seer in the center between the two hearts, the middle. The color of this point is green, like an emerald. The integration of the two hearts, the physical and the heart that is the one. Exhaling, following the same route back down. The next inhale goes further still, bringing us up to the spot between the two eyebrows on the forehead. We might feel a tingling there when the breath reaches it, so inhaling from the seat, nafs, blowing like a flute through the hearts, up through the seer, just tickling the point between the eyebrows, feeling a livingness there. And you can end the breath, the inhale, by opening the eyes. And as the breath rolls and becomes an exhale, let the eyes then close again and follow the breath back down to the root. Let's let go of the climb now and stay with the breath at the third eye. Keep the eyes closed and just feel the swing of the breath bringing presence and livingness and awareness to this now radiant spot. And feel with this the space just above the crown of the skull, maybe 10 inches high. On the inhale, we can feel something drawing down into this space that is of us, but yet above the physicality of our bodies. And come down into this same space on our brow. And on the exhale again, we can open our eyes. On the inhale, draw it back. Close the eyes. Next inhale, draw it down. On the exhale, open the eyes. It's like going to a reservoir and pulling up water from a well or letting something come down. So our breath is just a living example of our two dimensions of reality, our feet on the ground, our heart, our soul, of the heavens. or heart. Essentially, our being, the portal between. When you do open your eyes, remember we can stay mostly at home, so we can have a feeling of sitting back in this beautiful space we've made. And keeping ourselves mostly there, let the eyes float open and just let a little out, enough to be present with this group. Our subject today is Dunya and Jahan. I have an affinity for Jahan because it's in my name, and I guess I don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg. Jahan, meaning the real world, and Dunya, the one that we can say is sort of glommed on top of the real, and our task to differentiate, to figure out. It seems like today more than ever we live in two worlds. It's the first time that the whole world has actually been for sale. We're the first people to live in that aspect of reality, and that makes Dunya so easy to see, in a way. Everything sort of has a flag on it when everything's for sale. It's a real marker. And in Sufism, we talk about the 70,000 veils that separate these worlds, that is our work to do. And these metaphors are so helpful, so we can sort of track ourselves as we progress from one world to the other and begin to gain sight, which is essentially what we're trying so hard to do. There's a quote I love from Yogi Berra, the baseball player, who said, "If the world were perfect, it wouldn't be." And it's a nice reminder that we're not making like a devil of one of the worlds necessarily. It's if not for it, manifestation wouldn't be. So this is our dance, our art, our play, our reason for being. God's becoming, our becoming. There's a phrase that I love and use as a practice, which is, for transcendence, freedom is form. So I'll begin with a passage from Murshid that sets the ground for this conversation. "I passed away into nothingness. I vanished, and lo, I was living. All who have realized the secret of life understand that life is one, but that it exists in two aspects. First, as immortal, all-pervading, and silent, and secondly, as mortal, active, and manifest in variety. The soul being of the first aspect becomes deluded, helpless, and captive by experiencing life in contact with mind and body, which is of the next aspect. The gratification of the desires of the body and fancies of the mind do not suffice for the purpose of the soul, which is undoubtedly to experience its own phenomena in the seen and the unseen through its inclination to be itself and nothing else. The soul is of the first aspect, immortal. When delusion makes it feel that it is helpless, mortal, and captive, it finds itself out of place. This is the tragedy of life, which keeps the strong and the weak, the rich and the poor, all dissatisfied, constantly looking for something they do not know. The Sufis, realizing this, take the path of annihilation, fana, and by the guidance of a teacher, find at the end of this journey that the destination was he or she." As I wandered in pursuit of my own self, I was traveler and destination. So it was so clearly delineated here as the two worlds. And the soul's conundrum of trying to live in one that's really not its, of its own. So let's look at the two worlds in terms that we understand. So I've took some notes. Civilization is such a terrific way to throw dunya up. It's not complete, but it's a great living example of so many of the attributes. So dunya separates. I used to work in marketing, and my job was essentially to make distinctions for brands so we can divide people into categories so it's easier to sell things. You know, I was one part probably Prana and one part Burning Man and one part Apple, and you know, we can all kind of make these little funny lists of, you know, I'm Gap, and they'd be really telling in some ways. But essentially the process is one of division for sake of selling. And when I quit my career, I wanted to do like one thing great with those talents, and I made this event for repurposing textiles, and I gave it back as a gift, you know, one of those purging Sufi moments we have. And at this event, what we did is we took clothing, branding, and we ripped off all the brands, you know, hundreds of people, and sewing machines and scissors and glue guns and all these tools, and we ripped off all the brands, and then we hacked up all the clothes and we remade them into new forms. We unknitted sweaters and re-knitted them into dresses, and we turned bras into pocketbooks, and we just, you know. And what happened at these events that I got to see over and over and over again was, at the start of an event, people come in and they're actually still branded, and they're just kind of uncomfortable and not socializing yet, and it's a little bit awkward. And then as this starts to take place and the brands come off and everyone's hacking and cutting and, can I have that glue gun and pass me that weird red sweater? It's essentially the base is a clothing swap, so everything's free and there's just piles of clothing everywhere. And what I saw as a marketer was an unbranded identity that was greater than the division, which was creativity. That was an umbrella that held so much more. Everyone was able to stand under that umbrella. Nobody was in clusters and groups. Everyone was one, it was a big mosh pit of activity. So dunya's quality, we see, separates. Jahan, we're back to toward unity, toward the one. Dunya's focus is often on personal gain, in our time, so evident, wealth. And wealth, we see, has a quality of never being enough. We're never satiated by wealth. In fact, what it does produce in abundance is worry. Once we have something, we have to protect it and guard it and hope we don't lose it, and it becomes a whole new thing. And then today, we see more perhaps than at any time that there's like a new sickness, a new type of wealth of having enough and then having no idea that you have enough, which is like a new poverty. So we see the flimsiness of wealth. In Jahan, wealth is not wealth, it's abundance. It's not counted, it's celebrated, it's discovered. It's the nature of the world we've been given as our form for which to learn what's behind the form, which is plant one seed and get 100. It's abundance, and all it knows is making more. Abundance has the lovely attribute of ease. You don't count it or hoard it, and you don't really need to hold on to it, because its nature is that it's everywhere, and it's always there, and it never runs dry. So there's no worry. There's a calmness that comes with that. In the cultures that have had gift economies, what can be noted about the currency, which is gifts, is that its value is inherent only as long as the gift keeps moving. But as soon as somebody stops and takes the thing out of motion, I give something to you, and then you give it to her, and then you give it to her, and oh, I like that, I'll take it. As long as that's happening, it's valuable. But the minute somebody puts it in their drawer at home, the value stops. It's a useless object. This is where the term Indian giver came from. Because the Native Americans would give as they did. Oh, you, peace pipe, you know, hand it over. Hello, you new person. Give, give, give. And then they'd go to, like, the white man's house, and there's the peace pipe on the fire mantle. And they're like, the Indian giver was us. So, abundance, different from wealth. With wealth, there's a lot of scheming that has to then happen. I have to kind of get the best of you to get what I need. I have to be in artificial relationships that are based on gain, that have no authenticity beneath them. They're just, they're completely contrived for the acquisition of something. It's unnatural. There's a quote that I love. The merchant in love's bazaar is none other than the customer. Where then is the profit in trying to buy and sell? The merchant in love's bazaar is none other than the customer. Where then is the profit in trying to buy and sell? In the view of the one, we're selling. It's like our hand is selling our foot something. We already have it. Dunya is a limited world. So today, it can be so tempting to think it's the real because it's so impressive. Look at technology. Look at, you know, the wow. Go to Tokyo. It's like being in a pinball machine. It's so impressive, you know? Look at this building. It's so impressive. And yet, civilization is largely right angles, 180, three, you know, very predictable angles. It's reused again and again. It's the Mason's rules, right? There's a toolbox. It's the Pantone color wheel, which is a lot of colors. But, you know, over here in Jahan, a new color is being made right now. It's never going to stop. I just passed it on my Facebook page that they just discovered a new color blue. Just discovered it.
It must have been there all along.
One would think. So Jahan is creative. The nature of creation, creativity, is Jahan. It doesn't know but to make. It's ever changing, ever new, ever becoming, whereas Dunya is this very, very tiny limited subset that derives essentially from Jahan, and yet it can be, we so easily, and you know, in this very moment, believe it to be the real, so much so that we become utterly illogical within it. Well, you know, for example, we spend a good deal of our lives going to work every day, and many of us don't really enjoy the thing we're doing or know that it really has no contribution to the livingness of this world, and we do it anyway. And yet no one asks, what is the cost of a job? Like, this is the illogical nature of living in dunya and believing it to be the real. The cost is tremendous. The cost is our loved ones. The cost is we can't cook our own food because we don't have time. We have to buy it. We, you know, we're trading off the real for the artificial more and more and more. And it gets even stranger when we, the Jahan living system, start to show symptoms that dunya is not working. And rather than be the canary in the coal mine that we are and say, oh, this isn't working, we have to fix this system we've made, this echo of ourselves, we make pills and create ways to adapt to a dead system pharmaceutically. So the living is confusing itself and becoming the opposite. We're adapting to something dead. It's an echo And an interesting one and an important one, an echo of everything that has been till now. It's this incredible picture of the best we've been, the worst we've been, what we know and what we don't. And it's a picture that's meant to be revised by us. We're all the first of our kind. You're the first you. Hi. Right? Billions of years of evolution to produce this one new perspective and way of seeing and feeling and being. And somehow, because of the confusion of which world is real, we are adapting to Dunya. It's as though we're saying, you know, in spite of this living picture of nature and how unbelievable it is, nah, I'm not buying it. In Jahan, instead of contriving or scheming or looking for a way to prop it up, we can actually do this amazing thing, which is we can just do what needs to be done. Buckminster Fuller has a wonderful quote that brings life to this. He said, "The things to do are the things that need doing. That which you see need to be done, and that no one else seems to see needs being done. Then you will conceive your own way of doing that which needs to be done. That no one has told you how to do. This will bring about the real you that often gets buried inside a character that has acquired a superficial array of behaviors induced or imposed by others or the individual." The things to do are the things that need doing. That which you see need to be done, no one else seems to notice. Then you will conceive your own way of doing. That no one has told you how to do. What he knows in saying this is that you cannot intuit dunya. It has to be a livingness. There has to be the real in order to intuit. We are a part of the real. We are living. We can intuit Jahan because we are Jahan. We can ask for knowledge. We can tune ourselves to receive it. And we can know what we didn't know. In dunya, we need translators. You have to learn dunya because it's not natural. You have to study it. Someone has to teach you, you need a liaison, because it's not alive. So then it gets even more complex. We need translators, and we have specializers who help us know its code, from programmers to lawyers to accountants to technical, you know, it's wonderful, but you cannot intuit it. You have to learn it. It's not alive. There's no thread to learn through. And this shows us what he knows, which it points us to what is inner guidance, what is the common sense. That's our link. And it's free and waiting. In dunya, we feel small. Our lives, we presume, are, you know, 80 to 100 years, and then nothing exists. It's over. So it's easy in dunya to hoard and pillage and devour because there's nothing after it. It's fractured off, it's separate. In Jahan, we presume ourselves, our practice, you know, all mystics and Sufis, is I've been here on the first day of Earth, I'm going to see the last. All I do is re-arrive. How is it now? And so there's no need to take anything. Everything we do naturally, if this is your perception of yourself, that you're forever, is to just keep making this better so you can come back to it's better. Oh, it got a little better. And that comes naturally. We know, you know, people who, they've probably studied, people who do spiritual practice naturally are prone to acts of self-sacrifice. Because self-sacrifice. There is, you know, spiritual practice dissolves the self. It's only natural to, what follows is natural. Dunya's actions produce waste. It can only make waste because it's not living, it's not a maker of anything. It really just recapitulates. So what it makes has this byproduct that isn't, that's not part of a living system. It's nothing to uptake it. So we make waste upon waste upon waste by perceiving ourselves to be the one, the maker. In spite of a living system in parallel that is flawless and makes no waste at all. It's a perfect system. Everything is made out of Jahan in Dunya. It makes nothing of its own. Everything came from Jahan. In Dunya, there's many, many, many authors. Everybody takes credit. We have copyrights and patents, and I, you know, I'm a BMI songwriter. I'm taking credit. Where's my nickel for that song, right? Everyone's taking credit, lots of authors. In Jahan, there's just one, as Sufis, we know this well. In Dunya, we're naturally nervous and fearful, and every step can be frightening because we need to know that we know how to care for ourselves. It's just an innate part of being a human being. That's something that's supposed to be ingrained, that we know how to care for ourselves. And in Dunya, we actually know that we don't know, because it's not a true system. We know we're docked to something that really can't provide. In Jahan, we can be free of worry and trusting and step out into the world and feel powerful because we're docked to something real. My father is a terrific, him and I are a terrific example. He's just terrified, like, of everything. Every moment he thinks someone's going to rob him, and he's always like barreling up his protection. And sure enough, he always, these things happen to him. And he can't understand, you know, that the way that I live, oh, where are you going? I'm just going to crash pad my way across the country. Do you know anybody? No, it'll work out. You know, he just can't believe this. Cannot believe it. You know, heaven and hell are coexisting. Here we are. He's in hell. It's horrible to watch. And he sees something, but he doesn't know how to touch it. So when the snake oil salesman says, B12, 30 minutes in the sun a day, he just drops the previous plan and starts to listen. And then next week someone tells him something else, and he does that too, and he keeps dropping and listening and running and running and running, and he's exhausted. And he doesn't understand why I'm not exhausted. I'm calm, and I don't take the B12 because Jahan is informing me, you know, stick to the living. So finally, before a little shift, Dunya says we're limited and mechanistic. That's what it says we are. When we're in Dunya, we're limited and mechanistic. We're specialized. We have a part to play in, like a little machine. And in Jahan, we're unbounded and creative. The whole thing's ours. Bucky said it himself. If you want to do something, look for something that's not yet being done, and do it, and it doesn't matter if you knew anything at the start. It does not matter, because by wanting to do the work of the one, to fulfill something that needs to be done for the whole, the one provides the knowledge needed to complete the task. So, a few years ago I wrote a book, and it wasn't on my bucket list because it was the weakness that I had. Like, I knew I was an awful writer. I just was. I was married to an editor, he reminded me all the time, whatever you do, don't do that. So it wasn't even on my bucket list, but as a Sufi, I couldn't walk around with handicap. To say that that's true is to say that it's true of the one. God can't write if God wants to. You know, like, this can't be. You know, I'm not going to be a vessel for limitation, an example. So it's not that I just snapped my fingers. My Jewish mother loves to say, God helps those who helps themselves. I went out to meet the one, and I worked really hard, and I found someone to help me, and I worked at it. And then I wrote a book, and it's really good. You know, this is the nature. I didn't need to know, but I did need to meet the one in the world and bring what it gave me, which is a mind and a body. And I met the one with my senses and my stuff, and I worked. And then one met me back. And then we made something great together. And when you make something in alignment with the will, the only will, it tends to have, it goes where it should, the right place, the right things happen, the right things follow. It has a magnetism. Krishnamurti has a quote that is my favorite quote of all time. It is no sign of wellness to be well adjusted to a sick society. It is no sign of wellness to be well adjusted to a sick society. Lastly, we survive dunya, and we live life, we live jahan. We could say, as we consider these two worlds, that, you know, heaven has a hunter, and it's the one who is asleep and starts to dock to the dead world and believe. It's the ego that believes dunya to be real and keeps building it and supporting it and building it. It's like a hunter of paradise. Murshid said, there is in man a false self and a real self. The real self contains the eternal, and the false self contains the mortal. The real self has wisdom, the false self ignorance. The real self can rise to perfection, the false self ends in limitation. The real self has all good. The false self is productive of all evil. One can see both in oneself. God is the other one. By conquering the other one, one realizes God. This other power has been called Satan, but is it a power? It is really not. It is and it is not. It is a shadow. We see shadow and yet it is nothing. We should realize that this false self has no existence of its own. As soon as the soul has risen above the false self, it begins to realize its nobility. So our role in this, Murshid in this text speaks of the shadow. It has no life of its own, no life of its own. Our role, our discernment, we have the skill to see the differences. And some of the ways we can go about this is the mirror of our heart. We use the metaphor of a globe often. Has anyone ever heard the Sufi story of the Sufis in the cave and the artist painting a picture? Oh, great. It's a great story. So there's a lovely image for this. And there was a king, and he was loved, and he had a great kingdom, and he built a beautiful, beautiful kingdom. And he wanted a picture of it high up on a cave wall that overlooked the city. So all the artists rounded up, and everybody got paints, and they got the gold lamé and all this great stuff. And they were about to go paint the cave wall, this mural, and the Sufis came and said, we want to participate in this event. And they were like a little skeptical. And they said, well, what do you need? And they said, well, we just need some wine and rags. And they were like, all right. And they divided the cave in half with a curtain. Mm-hmm. They gave him wine and rags. You know the story.
Different context.
Yeah, they get recapitulated. So months go by, everybody's, you know, the Sufis on one side, making a bunch of noise, artists on the other side. And the day comes, and the town is all awaiting to see the end results, and they draw back first the curtain. The artist made the most beautiful of images, and there it was, a perfect, vivid, colorful picture of this city, and everybody was, you know, and then with a little bit of hesitation, they pulled the curtains back on the Sufi side, and it glistened, because what actually had happened is they just took the rags and they scrubbed the walls until it became a mirror. They polished and polished and polished and polished. And it was undeniably more beautiful than the painting because it was the city itself. It was a reflection of the actual city. It was living, it was moving. When the city moved, the image moved. And it's just a great way to see. You know, in that story, the wine is the drunkenness of the intoxication of our beloved, you know, our prayers and our devotion. And the mirror is our heart. And the beauty is what's actually there, not the prop, not the mimic, not the fossilized representation, but presence, which is happening now, arising. Not a picture, not a written word. What's interesting about when we are docking between these worlds and trying to find our way, as I had mentioned, you know, I'd quit my career in PR and marketing, realizing that it was toxic, you know, just making more people famous that didn't need to be famous and like selling widgets on the open market, you know. I could be doing something better with myself. And when I turned the same skills, because we're always ourselves, you know, you can quit, but you are, some part of you is in everything you do. There's some realness, you know, at the root. So, which is a great, you know, way to look at giving up your will. So I'm not gonna use these tools anymore. I'm gonna put this gun down, you know. And what happens immediately is you get all your skills back. You're still you, right? But when you turn your skills to the one and start to make things for the one with it, then your will and the will of the only will merge, and everything you make is like a rocket ship, essentially. You know, in my job, it was like so hard getting the media to write about something, or just everything was hard. You know, it's like carrying, you know, giant rocks up hills. But then when I turned it to the one, when I made a cure for materialism through that textile repurposing event, or did some, you know, artistic activism towards, you know, an expression against war, everything I touched was in like the newspaper the next day in Australia. You know, like, and I did nothing. The textile repurposing event I produced once. I placed it down in New York City. In a year, it was in about 20 some odd cities. In 5 years, it was in 135. Thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands. It's in Istanbul. It's in Paris. I did nothing but produce it once. It's not my will. When people say, you know, great job, I can't even hear the words because it's not mine. But I gave it my... I gave it back. I gave back what I had been misusing. And then it's the will of the one. And then there's no stopping. Listen, O drop, this is Rumi. Give yourself up without regret, and in exchange, gain the ocean. Listen, O drop, bestow upon yourself this honor, and in the arms of the sea be secure. Who indeed should be so fortunate? An ocean wooing a drop. In God's name, sell and buy at once. Give up a drop and take this sea full of pearls. When we go it alone, we struggle. It's like pushing rocks up hills. But when we give it back and turn it toward the one and give it, everything we do is for the all, not the self. I wouldn't make a nickel on that project. People offered me money left and right. I didn't even have a job at the time. And I was offered six figures multiple times over to let corporations brand it and all sorts of things. I had to sue Toyota, actually, I shouldn't say. Because they were stealing it. you know, and they tried to pay me, and I wouldn't do it because you cannot corrupt what is not yours. You cannot. So what to do? You know, what to do when we find ourselves in this place of, you know, we're making drugs to cause our adaption to this dead system. We're doing all these strange things, spending our lives in these strange ways that are unnatural, and essentially burying our common sense, making it really hard to find what to do. Murshid says the best way to meet within harmony is to harmonize with it. Knowing that the source and goal of all things is in the perfection of harmony, bearing in mind that if one met with in harmony, which has no existence, in reality, it's like a shadow. It must certainly disappear as shadows disappear in the light of the sun. It has no existence in reality. The Sufis say, have you heard the phrase, life lives, only death dies? Yeah. So life lives. We're Jahan. This is good news. Only death dies. So are we afraid if a monetary system slips out from under our feet and passes away? It had no life at all. It was never really supporting anything. We're life. Let this not slip away. What dies needed us as a host. Fear. Its memories, echoes of dunya, going back generations, mistakes, pain, that still need to be transcended and neutralized through form, us, livingness, be brought back into the world and released. For transcendence, freedom is form. So what dies is fear, clinging, feeling impoverished. It's not true. These things need a host. If we took boredom out of our vocabulary and waited three generations, yeah, there'd be an echo still in, like, the world, but it would just go away. It doesn't have life. We're the host. These are just parasites. We have so much power. Life lives, only death dies. So back to what Murshid had said, it's like a shadow, it has no existence. You know, when you bring light, the shadow disappears. There's a little Sufi story of a thief who comes into your house at night and steals from you, and, you know, the housekeeper matches the weapon of the thief. The thief has a knife, gets out a knife. The householder gets out a knife, the thief shows up with a knife. The householder takes out a bat, the thief shows up with a bat. You can't combat the ego in these ways, but you can turn the lights on, right? So this is just our awareness. You turn the lights on, the thief, which is a coward at heart, just goes running out the door. And this is entirely our practices as Sufis. What is the real? What is not the real? So how do we discern? So we actually have some really concrete tools for knowing the difference. We can, as we meet the world, we have common sense, and it gets stronger, better as we use it. The more we rely on it, it's like our brains. Our brains are dying constantly because they need so much fuel. And the only way to prevent this, they literally need fuel, like food and carbohydrates and food. They want to shrink. So the only way to prevent it is to use them, right, and feed them. So as you use your common sense and develop your common sense, your intuition gets stronger, better. Well, you don't even have to think. You're just like, oh, that's what that is, and off we go. So as we live and we bump into things, trust your soul's knowledge, and it's a simple phrase that you can take with you, dismiss that which insults your soul. So simple, it's like a little filter. And dismiss is not take a bat to, go to combat. It's just turning on the lights. It's just dismiss. We don't have to understand everything. Thread, weave a path of beauty. We can remember if we come into something, what is this, you know? Is this real? It doesn't have any life. Look for life. Presence is arising. If it causes a disruption to life, harmony, beauty, it's probably dunya. We were talking this morning over breakfast at how in dunya today, you know, everybody's kind of, we're all wonderful, but you know, we have these little worlds where you're like, well, I know I work at Monsanto, but I'm just the accountant, you know? I just do numbers, so I'm really innocent, you know? And this is a good person who has a family that they love, and it's great, you know, but, right? We have to turn on the lights and see the bigger picture. We have to be willing to see, but we know not everybody's ready, and there's so much frustration in that. So another little contemplative phrase to help is, ignorance is a shield for that which we're not yet ready to face. Not everybody's ready to turn on the lights as much as you, or maybe they can just turn it on this much. It hurts to know the world. It's responsibility. You can't back away from it. Once you start opening it up, you might have to change your friends. You might have to confront people. You know, things change. We know this as Sufis. So we have to, when you, you know, look at something that is just so absurd to you and frustrating because you know what you know and it's, the knowledge hasn't met that spot yet. Just a way for us to cope is, ignorance is a shield for that which we are not yet ready to face. It brings compassion. Another thing is, stand your ground. And know there is a ground, right? You're on the one that's actually there. If you're standing in love and harmony and beauty, if you're seeing John. So, there's a Sufi practice I thought we would do together, and then maybe we can talk a little about some of this as a group. I think we have a few minutes, yeah. Yahayo, Yahayo, it's the flow of life. Yakayum, I'm going to read these words because they're from Physicians of the Heart, which is such a wonderful book. Yakayum, eternal, who remains through all the permutations of time and space, beyond appearance and form, manifest in everything, and all under the watchful guidance of the One, Yakayum. All that remains through all the permutations of time and space, beyond appearance or form, manifest in everything, and under the watchful guidance of the One, Yakayum. Yahayo, the flow of life, coming and the going, the flow of life. So we'll do this together. As a zikr, did it? Oh, can I borrow those beads for a minute?
Sure.
I'm always forgetting my beads. Oh, good. Thank you. You heard the call. So these don't have the counter, so I'm going to indiscriminately pretend that this is probably somewhere around.
It has little discs in between. 33.
We're going to pretend this is 11 and just maybe it is. We'll do Yahayo, Yakayum, Yahayo. It's like an infinity symbol. Yakayum, Yahayo.
May I adjust your microphone for a sec? Sorry.
It's all right?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay. So we know the infinity symbol? Yeah. So this brings us to sort of this quality of this, you know, ever-flowing, entirely all under the guidance of the One, but yet this sort of, well, I won't add any more words. Here's maybe 11. Yahayo, starting on the left. Yahayo will go left to right across the three hearts and up. Yakayum, back to the heart. Yahayo. Yakayum, Yahayo, Yakayum, Yahayo, Yakayum, Yahayo, Yakayum, Yahayo, Yakayum, Yahayo, Yahayim. 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 We'll count another 11 approximately silently in your taking it deeper within, thicker asir. You can use the movement if you like, but it won't intone. And just sit back in stillness and sense into the quality left behind by Yahayo, Yahayim. Mean. Thank you. I hate to quote myself, but I'm going to quote myself from my book. The philosopher's stone is hidden in the heart of the sincere. It is the only safe place for a thing of value. If you were the one lost in your manifestation, lost in dunya, trying to find yourself and become, dunya's dangerous, you know? Where would you put your secret? Where would you put all the knowledge of yourself? Where would you hide that treasure? In the heart of the sincere. You can't fake sincerity. Just can't. So just to explore it a little together, I thought I would just prompt us with a question. We'll see if we like this question. I have a backup if we don't like this question. This is also from my book, but it's Pirzia's quote. The past is our heritage, the future is our legacy, and the present is our moment of truth. The past is our heritage, the future is our legacy, and the present our moment of truth. So the question is, where in our time do we see the interplay of dunya and jahan? And how might turning on the lights have an effect?
I think about that story with the reflection. See, my take on that is that there's the painting, which is real, in the sense that it's there. And the mirror reflects what is real, and it's more beautiful. I see the mirror as us, consciousness, perception of the one. So that is saying that there's an interaction between the one and those that, in a sense, interact with it. That's an ongoing thing. So, Johanna and Dunya, from that perspective, I would put the emphasis, I mean, I totally agree with everything that you've said, but it's not one or the other, it's an interaction. Mm. And I think that's where the emphasis should be, because we have to live in the world. That's part of the deal. So we are creating the thing that is of most beauty by virtue of being here and, in a sense, being separate from it.
Mm.
This sounds like it
yes.
relates to what you were speaking to there. And I don't know how much it speaks to your question.
It's okay.
It's an experience that I have of interacting with the world of illusion and knowing that it's illusory and knowing that, that fundamentally it's an anti-life system. And yet also having the sense that that's God too. That even Dunya is God too. And I guess maybe it's another question in a way. It's just how to interact with that knowledge. Like, I don't want to be in a place of shunning or trying to excise it from my life in some way. I want to be in acceptance with it.
It's a constant interaction. It's not one or the other. It's an interaction. We create constantly. It's not one's good and one's bad. Mm-hmm. You create it.
Mm. Free will. Well, we know beauty by its opposite. You know, in duality, we only know one thing by the other. Resonating with the cave story as you are feeling it, it points to also just relationship. You know, it's you know, pain when you're pressed against the glass. In life, you know, just embodied, no heart, no soul, disconnected, just in life. Everything is like, oh, wow, like really hurts, you know, it's very stingy. But when we step back from it, pain can be like a flicker, like oscillating, you know, it looks like a vibration or a wave. You keep stepping back, or it could just be like a tap, like a psychic pressure. And, you know, as we get closer to the one, I think, you know, it might be something like majesty. If we look at it as a dance in motion, the pain comes with the part, the last layer, the body and mind. This story this week. I wasn't no plan to tell this story. It's up twice now. I recently started to run because I was going to lose my hip. They were going to take my hip in surgery. It just failed. So I started running because I was like, well, I'm not going to be able to run, so let me just run this thing to the ground and I'll come crawling in and you can have it. And it's really painful.
And I just, like, really run, and I just kept running. And then I couldn't run a half a mile. Now I'm running 25 miles. Just kept running. And I went to the doctor, and I got an MRI, and they were like, you can keep this hip for 25 years. The one thing they told me not to do is run. Don't run. Whatever you do, don't run. And when I run, not just my hip, but, like, everything hurts, everything. I'm in pain all the time. I don't feel it as pain anymore. I know it is pain, and my brain knows it's pain. I feel it as God touching me, telling me I got my hip back, I got a gift. Every time I feel that pain, I just see a gift. I just see, like, I look wider with my eyes, and I breathe deeper, I run on trails, and I take it in, and I jump, like, heroically off, like, the rock, you know, because I get to do this, and I almost couldn't. So, yeah, it hurts. But only in dunya. You know, when I step back far enough toward closer to the real, it feels like love. It feels like an embrace. It gave me the ability to love that smell on that mountain and get to the top where I get to see the alpine lake. It's not pain. I don't know if that's an answer, but I mean, it just depends on how we, like, we're, you know, in that I'm seeing us as an aperture, a lens, and we can change it. We can come get not so close. I don't know if anyone's ever met Pandit Mukesh. He's one of the Saluk teachers. He's a classical Indian musician. And he just tells these really great stories of just all the pain is when we're too embodied and we did, and then the soul and heart are not with us in our bodies. How about life lives, only death dies? What perishes? Or how, here's a question. How does it feel to be imperishable? How does it feel to be imperishable? Jahan.
To be what?
Imperishable. We're the stuff of Jahan.
Feels good.
How does it feel to be imperishable? You can keep answering. I'll just repeat the question and see. Just if something arises, if nothing does, fine. But how does it feel to be the imperishable?
Are you talking about the soul? How does it feel?
It feels like there's always a way out, even if you're stuck somehow. Mm. Sooner or later.
How does it feel to be the imperishable?
There's enough time for everything.
It's nice, relaxing.
Mm-hmm. That's what I meant, is that you have time, you can work your way out of the dunya. Find the Johanna and continue to connect with the one and become more in the Johanna way. You have time to do
but
it.
My name has now become Jahan.
Jahan. Oh,
we're dissolving boundaries.
I find that really hard to answer. It's funny. I mean, I have a real sense of it, but it's so hard for me to put that into words. It's like there's something there.
Mm. In the sense of feeling like a witness?
Yeah. Mm. Possibly. Mm-hmm. Like there's just something there that sort of continues. Mm.
I really only ask questions I don't know answers to because that's what I'm in it for. We have just a minute, so I'll close with a very short Rumi poem, and maybe we can close with the universal. Suppose you know, says Rumi, suppose you know the definitions of all substances and their derivatives. What good is this to you? Know the true definition of yourself. That is indispensable. Then, when you know your own definition, flee from it, that you may attain to the one who cannot be defined, O sifter of dust. Thanks so much for coming. I know I'm up against a big guy on. It's hard to be in a time slot with, for good reason. If I was not teaching, I too would be with Guyon. O thou who art the maker, molder, and builder of the universe, build with thine own hands the universal, our divine temple, for thy message of love, harmony, and beauty. Amen.